Welcome to the Next Level Soul Podcast, where we ask the big questions about life. Why are we here? Is this all there is? What is my soul's mission? We attempt to answer those questions and more by bringing you raw and inspiring conversations with some of the most fascinating and thought-provoking guests on the planet today. I am your host, Alex Ferrari. Have you ever wondered what a major film and television star's journey was from obscurity to becoming a worldwide figure, and that journey and what guided them to that journey and how they were able to achieve it? Well, today's guest takes us on her journey to fame, fortune, and also what she does with that fame and fortune to help other people. We have on the show today philanthropist, actress, writer, director, producer, Eva Longoria. And many of you might know Eva from her hit show Desperate Housewives, along with countless other feature films and television shows. Eva and I really dig deep into her path, how she was guided to her career, how meditation and mindfulness help her balance herself and what she does every day, and much, much more. So let's dive in. I'd like to welcome to the show Eva Longoria. How are you doing, Eva?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for talking about this amazing documentary.
I loved it, by the way. I absolutely loved it. I knew about it. I knew about the story, just being Latino in general. And I would tell, like, I told my dad, I'm like, do you remember this fight? He goes, who? If you're Latino, you remember that fight. But I didn't really understand the whole back and forth between the subcultures, if you will, of Mexico, Mexican-American, anything. But before we get started, and we're going to talk all about the documentary, how did you go from almost becoming a physical therapist to becoming an actor?
I know. My dream was to work for the Dallas Cowboys. Like, I was like, I'm going to be a physical trainer for the Dallas Cowboys, and I've arrived. I was in a beauty pageant. It was a scholarship pageant in Texas. It was my final year in college. I ran out of money. I ran out of Pell Grant. Like, I had no way to finish my senior year. And my friend's like, hey, why don't you enter the scholarship pageant? And I was like, what's that? And she's like, you know, if you win, you get money for school. So I did. And I was like, I'd never been, and I'm from Texas, like, we're born and bred football and pageants. And I'd never seen one. I'd never been in one. And so my goal was to win fourth place, because I was like, if I could just get fourth place, it was like books, right? Like, I was like, okay, I'll cover my books. And then, like, third place was like books, tuition. And then, you know, second place was books, tuition, boarding. And then first place was books, tuition, boarding, and a stipend. Like, I was like, look, I ain't aiming high. I just want my books, right? Mm-hmm. And then they called the winners, and they were like, fourth place is so and so, and I was like, oh man, I didn't get it. And I ended up winning the whole thing, and I was like, oh okay, cool. I can pay my senior year. And then that pageant made me. It was like a feeder to go into the next level, and I was like, oh, I don't want to make this a thing. I wanted my tuition. And so I had to go into the next one, which was Miss Corpus Christi, where I'm from. And I won that one.
Oh, wow.
And literally my mom was like, this is not your future. Like, you cannot enter one more pageant. I'm like, I don't want to. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what, especially growing up as La Prieta Fea, which is like the ugly dark one. And so in that prize package, Miss Corpus Christi, was a trip to Los Angeles. And that was the first time I was like, oh, that'd be fun. I've never been outside of Texas. And it was like a talent competition in LA that we had to go to. And so I came, and then I won the talent competition, and I was like, what is going on? I don't know what I'm doing. And literally, agents and managers wanted to sign me. And because it was like the Latin craze. I remember it was like Ricky Martin.
Oh, Ricky Martin, Jennifer Lopez, Enrique Iglesias. Yeah.
Living La Vida Loca was, you know, the hit song at the time. And they were like, oh my God, if you're Latina, you're going to like clean up here in Hollywood. They're looking for Latinas. And I was like, oh, okay. And I just, from one day to the next, said, okay, I think I'm going to be an actor. Just like that.
And
it was because I had my bachelor's degree that I was like, well, I can get a job anywhere. It's not like I'm going to be a starving actor. I can go get a job. So I had a lot of confidence that I would be okay. But still not knowing, you know, the industry or anything. I had $23 in my bank account.
Now, and you decided that, you know, you just like, I heard somewhere that you just called up your parents. It's like, yeah, I'm staying. I'm not flying back.
I didn't even fly back. That's right. When I moved to LA, I didn't even fly back to go, okay, let me prepare for this move. No, I came here for 3 days. And on the third day I said, I think I'm going to stay. And my mom was like, okay, you're going to do what? And I said, I think I'm going to be an actor. I mean, I don't know what that means, but I think I'm going to just stay a little longer and see what happens. And my mom said that, well, you know, at least you can get a job. You have your degree. And I said, yeah, I'm going to go get a job. And, you know, went, got a job and then became a background actor and, a atmosphere actor for a couple years. Cause I was like, let me be on a set. I've never been on a set. Maybe I should figure that out. You know?
Right. Right. Now, did you feel, because I mean, everything seems very serendipitous that you've just, that story you've told me, did you feel like there was some force, something guiding you during this process?
It's so funny you say that. I always say that. I was like, I don't know what it was, but there was something just that felt right every step of the way. Like they were like, I said, I'm going to stay. I wasn't scared. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have money. And I was like, I'll be okay. I'm going to be okay. maybe it's naive, you know, naive.
Youth. It's youth. It's youth.
It's bliss. Like if I knew the dangers, maybe I wouldn't have done.
Right, exactly. No, it's like, so any actresses living, listening right now, please don't do what Eva did. Don't do it.
I had like 5 roommates in a 1-bedroom of people who were like, hey, come live with us. I go, okay. Like not knowing them, I was just like, I could have been murdered. I mean, you know what I mean? Like
something was guiding and protecting you during this process, because the story that you just told me ends at Dateline.
Exactly. Well, that and like, there's no recipe for success in Hollywood. So let's say you do exactly what I did. You wouldn't get the same result. It doesn't work that way.
No, it's different timing, different place, different everything. I mean, you hit at the right point, right time. But like you were saying, it took you a little while before you started getting some jobs. How did you keep going? Like just, I mean, I'm assuming like I always treat – whenever I'm casting for a movie, I treat actors with such respect because it's so hard. And going on auditions and getting beat up and people just walking in and like, oh, you're too this or you're too that. And it's just so – it's so rough. How did you keep going when there was no real signs that this was the right path for you?
Right. 100%. Well, you know, when I came to Hollywood, I went to a temp agency to get a job because I was like, well, they'll have a job for me tomorrow. And that company said, why don't you work here? And I said, what do you guys do? And they were like, we're headhunters. You find people jobs and, you know, it's like matchmaking job people, you know, and I go, okay. I mean, not knowing anything, but I was so good at it. I made a lot of money. So again, I wasn't ever the struggling actor. I was so good. I was like, this is so easy, this headhunting thing. But I just like, I knew how to match people up with jobs, and all my actor friends were jobless. So I'm like, I got tons of supply, you know?
Right.
And because of that, I got an apartment. I had a car. I paid off my student debt. I paid off my credit card debt. I had headshots. I took acting classes. I really invested anything that I made back into myself. Right. And it was through one of those workshops or seminars or something that a casting director saw me and said, hey, you should audition for Young and the Restless. And I was like, okay. And then that was like my big break was Young and the Restless. And it paid so badly. It was like 2 cents for the week that I kept my headhunting job. So I was a headhunter in my dressing room at Young and the Restless, because I was not making enough at Young and the Restless to quit my job for 2 years. I did this, did both jobs.
Talk about hustle.
Yeah. I know that's the other thing is like, it is about hustle and it's about, you know, being resourceful, and that's life, by the way. That's just, if you drop me in the middle of Paris, I'm going to figure it out. Right. Mm-hmm. I speak the language. I don't know, but I'm going to eat and I'm going to eat well, and I'm going to figure it out. And that's, I think, what's missing a lot from a lot of the younger generation today is they're just not that resourceful, and they have all the tools in the world at their fingertips. I didn't have an iPhone. I had a Thomas guide and a printout from Google that I had to follow, you know? And so, I was like, oh, if I had the tools that you have today, I would have gone far.
Oh my God. I mean, it's the same here. I mean, my first director's reel cost $50,000 because I had to shoot it on 35, you know? And it was like, now we just grab a phone and you could be shooting commercials and music videos and short films all day. There's so much technology. I think it's because, you know, you and I are of similar vintage. So, you know, when we grew up, there wasn't anything. Like I remember there's no internet. I remember very easily there was no internet. I remember printing out the Google Maps in LA and having the directions like printed out line by line, driving around LA trying to drop off a demo reel for, you know, an editing gig or something like that.
At Backstage West. I submitted myself for auditions, and I would send my headshot, and I would use the postage from the company I worked at, so I didn't have to buy stamps.
Obviously.
And so I was like, at the end of the day, I'd sneak off and I'd go, bah, 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 and I'd put postage on like 20 submissions. So I was like, oh yeah, I was a hustler. I did background work just to eat. And I would steal the bananas and apples and take it home because I was like, well, I might not eat tomorrow. So let me take some of these bananas. Yeah.
And so, I mean, you struggled, but you were something again was guiding you and giving you these opportunities that the normal acting story in LA is not yours by any stretch of the imagination. Even at the very beginning, like you're living, you're eating, you're eating well. You have a job, you have a car, you've paid off student debt. Like this is unheard of for a struggling actor. But yet even then, when you got your first big break, you're like, yeah, I'm still going to keep my day job.
Yeah. I still like my car. So I think I like my apartment. Let me just keep doing this. Also, you know, what you said, like what kept you going? Cause there was no signpost to say success is a year from now. Hang on.
Right.
I felt it. And I remember my boss at that company, he goes, you know how much money you can make here. You're so good at this. Give up that dumb dream. Like, you know how many people make it in Hollywood? One in a million. Like you come on, just focus over here and forget that stuff. And I said, I know. And I'm that one. Like I'm taking up that space. So I've got to hurry up and be prepared. Like I really thought that. I never gave myself if I don't make it by 30, I'm moving back home. Like I never had a plan B. I was just like, no, this will happen. And I also approached it like a business. I knew exactly how to invest in, you know, what I need classes. I don't know how to do that. I'm not good at that. I'm going to do this. And at that time, you know, when you're going out for Latin roles, they're like, can you do it with an accent? And I'm like, I don't have an accent. Like there's other levels of, muchas gracias. And there's other levels of Latinos, you know, and it was like Rosie Perez. Yes, tiene? Okay. Gracias. There's other levels of, dimensions of Latinos that don't sound like Rosie Perez, you know? And, and so I was like, I need an accent coach. I don't have an accent. I need to get one. And so right. I did that. When people come to Hollywood, they try to lose their accent. I was like, I was trying to get an accent.
Now, so it sounds like that you really put an intention involved. You really had an intention and almost manifested what you were trying to get. Like you're like, no, I'm there already. In your mind, you were already successful, even though there was no signs at all. And there's a difference between delusion, because we all understand.
I might have been a little delusional.
Listen, Eva, look, to be in our business, you got to be insane. You got to be insane in general. It's an insane business. It's like running off with the circus, basically. You know, so it is an insanity to be with. But yeah, there is a little. You need a little delusion to even think you could make a movie. Is a delusion. It's insanity.
Yeah, I mean, it is a little delusional. But the other thing that I had on my side was, I'm an insane optimist and a hard worker. So I knew those two went together. But I also felt, I have very tough skin. So the no's didn't affect me. And I got thousands. thousands. The day I got Desperate Housewives, the day I auditioned for Desperate Housewives, I had 9 auditions that day. And I was changing in my car, driving from Disney back to Warner Brothers, back to Disney, back to Sony, back to Culver City. And it was like, oh my, I ran out of gas that day. That's how many auditions I had. And Desperate Housewives was at 8 at night. It was the last audition. I'm changing in the car and I get there and I'm exhausted. And I just was like, the other 7 auditions today said no. I already knew I didn't get them. And it was like, in the car, doctor, okay, lawyer, okay. And then Gabby was like sexy. And I'm like trying to put on this tight dress in the car. I get down and Mark Cherry is in the audition and he goes, so what'd you think of the script? And I was like, what? I didn't read the script. Like in my head, I'm like, I read my part. Like who has time? I had 8 auditions today. I'm not going to read 8 scripts. And I said, you know what? And I was just done. I was done for the day. And I said, you know what? I didn't read it. I didn't read the script, but I read my part and my part's really good. And he told me later, he knew I was Gabrielle in that moment because it was the most selfish thing to say. I don't know about everybody else, but I'm amazing. I'm amazing. And I was like, so can I just do the audition so you can say no, so I can go? Like it was just, yeah. And then you did it again the next day, right. And you started all over. So I had this, I have very thick skin. Even to this day, I really never take things personal. If I get reviewed badly or this, I'm like, it's not your cup of tea.
Now, do you feel that you getting Desperate Housewives a little bit later in life, because you weren't 20, I think you were 30. You were like
29.
Yeah, exactly. 29 when you got it. So you already kind of had you've established who your identity was at that point. Do you think that helped you deal with the tsunami, of fame and criticism and love and hate and everything that comes along with that package? Did that help you with that? Because that crushes many.
Yeah. 1,000%. I knew who I was. I probably knew who I was when I landed in Hollywood. I didn't drink. I wasn't into drugs. I didn't smoke. Like I was pretty, and everybody's like, oh my God, Los Angeles, you're going to, get into drugs and trouble. And I was like, there's drugs and trouble in Texas. Like this is the same thing. But I had a really strong sense of who I was. And so when this fame hits you, thank God I was 29. I mean, cause I was like, especially back then the tabloids were like the leading thing, not like social media today, but like the tabloids defined you. And so it was like America's sweetheart, America's sex kitten. And then you kind of became that, right? Like if you look at Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera coming up at the same time, and one was America's sweetheart and one was the bad girl. And they were babies and they kind of go, okay, I got to play the part now. I've got to be the bad girl. And so they tried to do that with me. And I was like, ha, no, that's not, no, I'm not that. And I'm very grounded. I have a really great family and I have, great friends. My friends back then are, the couches I slept on and I didn't have a dress for an audition. And my best friend, lent me a dress. They're still my friends today. They're the girlfriends that, travel with me and lived with me and, but I they were there for me when I had nothing.
So you know that they're true friends at that point. Yeah. Because you never know. Fame is such a double-edged sword. So many people want to be rich and famous and you're like, but look at how many people who are rich and famous who are destroyed by it. It's just Hollywood is riddled with stories like that. You're an exception. You're an anomaly.
Yeah, thank you. But you remember E! True Hollywood Story?
Oh, of course.
This thing that was on E! And it was like, she was such a pretty girl from Missouri. And you're like, and then they tell you like the downfall of everybody. And I remember we premiered and literally 3 days later, there was an E! True Hollywood Story on me. And I go, what did I do? Did I fall from grace? Did I do drugs? What happened? Like I was like, is this the beginning of the end now? Like, isn't this supposed to happen later? It was so funny.
Oh God. And then of course, any movies that you might've done before Desperate Housewives, they start going into, they go into the archives of the stuff that you did to like, look at what she did back then.
Yeah. And I did so many student films for real,
Yeah.
I just needed real. And did so many bad things. And then all of a sudden I was at Blockbuster. I don't know if people remember, there was a Blockbuster mm-hmm, where you had to mm-hmm. physically go and get a DVD before Netflix mailed them to you. I remember going into Blockbuster and my face is on the cover of this film. And I was like, what is that? It was a different title. It was just a student film I had done. And this director packaged it, sold it on my name. And I never knew until I saw it at Blockbuster. But yeah, yeah. And family comes out of the woodworks, right? Like all these people who are related to you. Yeah. A friend of mine who was on another hit show, and every time he gets recognized around the world, he gets so pissed off because he's like, that's all people know me for. And every time people come up to me and they go, Gabby Solis, I am like, yes, that's me. You know, I'm just so grateful. And so like, so grateful that that director thought I had some sort of value. Cause that's what you hope for. You know what I mean? You hope to have enough value that you can make something happen.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
No question. And I read somewhere that you're an avid meditator. How do you, I've been meditating for years. I meditate hours a day sometimes. And it's changed my life. How do you use meditation in your balancing your insane world that you live in with all the things that you do and all the plates you spin, mother and philanthropist and actor and director and all these kind of things? How does meditation help you kind of balance yourself, and what does it do for you in general?
You know what? It really centers you before the day. I have to do it first thing in the morning, and it makes me more patient. It makes me have compassion. It makes me have, it really just shifts your energy to a place of positivity and a place of gratitude. That's a big one. You know, I really learned also to be aware of how you speak. Right. So I used to be like, I have to go to this meeting across town. I have to go to this audition. I have to go do, James Corden, or I have to be on Jimmy Kimmel tonight. And instead, just switching it to, I get to, right. I get to go have a meeting about a project. I want to get off the ground. Like, isn't that what you want? So why are you going, I get to be on Jimmy Kimmel to promote this TV show I was on. I get to, I have to get home and bathe my kid. No, I get to make it home in time to bathe my child and put him to bed. Like, I get to do that. I get to cook dinner for my family. And just that little word was through meditation, right? Like, be careful of how you speak in life. You know, when people go, how was your day today? You go, oh, so busy. I'm so busy. It's like, it's just too much. I'm so busy. And switching that word to productive. How was your day? Productive, right? I was so productive today. I had 8 meetings. I had, this deal go through. I had this conversation with so-and-so. It was a pretty productive day. It wasn't a busy day. You're not doing busy work. Everything you do during the day is towards a goal, towards something. So have that gratitude in your words as you approach your day. And that's what meditation does. It really makes you think about things that are on autopilot that you shouldn't be on autopilot about.
And yeah, I agree with you 110%. You also are an insane philanthropist. You give back so much. Can you just talk a little bit about what giving back means to you and how it affects your life? Because when I started my show 6.5 years ago, I was trying to get in. I was trying to, I was trying to knock on the doors and try to get these meetings and try to make connections. And I said, I'm tired of all that. I'm going to start giving back to my community, which is filmmakers. And all of a sudden doors swung open, and now I get to talk to people like you and all this kind of things. It was because I gave back, and it's addictive, the giving back and changing people's lives in whatever, which way I can, with this show or with whatever other work I do. So how does that affect you?
Yeah. I mean, you hit it right in the nail. I mean, it's studies have proven, giving and being charitable, increases your life's, fulfillment, right? Like you're like, oh, I didn't even know I needed this to be filled. and then it becomes addictive. Like now I travel all over the world. I go to India. I go to, cause I just like love, philanthropy and community efforts. But honestly, I grew up with it in my DNA. I mean, I have a special needs sister. She was born with a mental disability. So I grew up in her world. I grew up with other people helping us, you know, charities that, you know, sponsored a trip for her to go to Disneyland, charities who, you know, created after school programs for kids with special needs to have a place to go. And so I always like, who's Charity? She's so sweet. She's so nice, that lady, you know? And so I knew before I was even famous that I was going to, you know, do something charitable and give back. And then once I got my platform and my microphone, then I was like, oh, okay, I have something to say.
And I could do some good in the world.
Yeah.
Now, when did you decide that you wanted to make the, or to add directing as part of your resume? Because so many actresses and actors, they just go on their whole life and they're just actors and they don't want to do any directing. But I've seen and I've spoken to many actors who have turned director, what it does for them. And it also elongates their career. They can direct until they're whatever and just really enjoy that process. When did you decide? At what point in your career did you go, I think I want to direct, which is the cliche of everything. What I really want to do is direct.
Yeah. I know. I think I'm better at this than these idiots. People think I'm an actor turned producer director. And I think I was always a producer, especially producer. I loved the business side of our business. You know, that's why my approach with myself was like, business. All right, I got to do this. I got to do that. I like, how do I set myself up for success? And I remember when I moved to Hollywood, I checked out, I went and bought a book at, oh my God, Samuel French, right?
Oh, of course, in Studio City.
No, in Hollywood.
There's another one. That was the second. Yeah, that's before they moved, I think. Yeah.
And Sunset, how to produce 101. I mean, I bought that book first over acting because I was like, well, I got to create my own project. So how do I do that? And there was like a sample budget in the book, and I put it on my Excel spreadsheet, and I was like, okay, plugging in numbers, and then I quickly had a gig with this show called Hot Tamales Live with Kiki Melendez at the Improv. Mm-hmm. And Kiki was like, hey, help me book some comedians. And then I said, well, how are we going to pay them? She's like, I don't know. And then so we asked the Improv, like, well, how much is it to get the night? They had a dead night. And we're like, we want to make it Latin night. Okay, great. You can have the stage. We get the door. You get the drink, you know. And it was just like, you figure it out, right? And I was like, okay. We watched tapes, VHS tapes of comedians, and to book out the night. And then we got a sponsor. I was like, well, we need a sponsor, right? We need somebody to pay for this. So we should get a tequila. We should get a tequila company to give us money. And then we'll mention the tequila on stage. Like, it was all shooting from the hip, you know, wow. And figuring out as you went. And I did that first. And then through that, directed some of the sketches we had on stage. I'm like, no, you've got to come out through there, and we're going to hear some props, and, you know, blah, blah, and fell in love with it. And then, you know, became an actor, and then used Desperate Housewives as my film school. I didn't go to film school, but I was on a set for 10 years. So I was like, paid attention to where the camera went, what lenses, what are lenses? What does that mean? 25, 35, 110, 100. Like, why is that light there? What are you doing? What's a bounce? You know, checking the gate, you know, like you said,
back in the day,
checking the gate. What does that mean? Well, you know, I used to load the camera when we were one of the last shows to go digital. We shot on film for much longer than other TV shows. And so I paid attention, and I really took advantage of all the directors that came through and asked them questions. And I was just a sponge. And so that's when it was on during Desperate Housewives where I said, I think I want to direct TV. And then somebody asked me, hey, you want to direct this short film? And I go, yes. And the minute I said yes, I wanted to put it back into my mouth. Cause I was like, why did you just said yes. You're not ready. You don't know enough. What are you doing? Who do you think you are? And I think women encounter that imposter syndrome a lot, you know, yeah. Like, oh no, I'm not ready. I couldn't possibly do that. No, I'm not. No, not me. But I had already said yes. So I was like stuck and I had to do it. And I was good. And I knew I was good at it. And I one of my mentors who directed a lot of Desperate Housewives, David Grossman, he came on set and I was like, well, you just be on set because what if I fuck up the lens choice? Whatever. He goes, that's not your job, by the way. Your job is to get performances, da, da, da. And after we wrapped, the DP and that director goes, I think this is your calling. And they really like gave me that confidence of
that's
like,
awesome.
you belong. This is, you know what you're doing, man. Man, do you know what you're doing? You know a lot more than you think you know. And I was like, really? Okay. And then I did it again. And then I did it again. And then, you know, cut to now we're, you know, 10 years later, I've been directing, and this is my first feature length, documentary in my feature length film.
Which comes to La Guerra Civil. How did this project come together? Like, I mean, how did it, you know, no one had ever done a boxing documentary about, you know, Mexican American that I know of, at least anything major. There's a Muhammad Ali one for every five minutes. There's a new Muhammad Ali documentary, and they're all fantastic. And then there's a Mike Tyson, Mike Tyson and Sugar Ray and everything, but never really about the Latino, you know, which has a fame in boxing. Jesus Christ. I mean, Jesus. Oh, gosh, yeah. So
everybody goes, did you grow up with boxing? I go, I'm Mexican. Of course I grew up with boxing. Like, it's in our blood. We have to, you have to. But no, you know, I've known Oscar for 25 years. Oscar right. and I have been friends. He was one of the first people I met when I moved to Hollywood. Me, Mario Lopez, and Oscar De La Hoya were like the little rascals. We ran around in Hollywood and just caused trouble. And this was 25 years ago. And so he called me and he was like, hey, this is the 25th anniversary of that fight. Can you direct the documentary about it? We want to do a documentary about how iconic the fight was. And I said, oh God, what do you mean? No, like a boxing doc, like jabs and punches and stuff. Like, no, I don't want to do that. I said, but you know what's so funny? I remember that fight dividing my household. Like, I remember that fight causing so much ruckus within our community and the fighting and the, you know, we couldn't get the fight because it was closed circuits. You had to go to a bar and then kids couldn't go. And it was like, it was a whole thing and people, the betting and Vegas and the odds. And I was just like, what is happening? Whoa, what is happening? And it was just, I think the biggest fight we've ever had in the golden age of boxing. I mean, that time, which was the Mike Tyson era, you know, the De La Hoya era, the Julio era, you know, it was huge. And I said, that's interesting to me to explore is through the lens of what does it mean to be Mexican enough? And how do you navigate your identity as a Mexican American? That is something I know. You know, I straddle the hyphen every single day of my life. And people go, oh, you're half Mexican, half American. And I go, no, I'm 100% Mexican and 100% American at the same time. And these two things can always be true. And so I knew Oscar navigated that because, when he won the gold medal for the Olympics, he wins the gold medal for the USA and he goes into the ring and holds a Mexican flag up. So he has the American flag and the Mexican flag. And I remember that moment too. And I remember swelling with pride and going, oh my God, that's me. Oh, so you can celebrate being Mexican, you don't have to hide it, you know, right. And all the Mexican people in the United States embraced Oscar in that moment. They were like, he's ours, you know, what pride. The Mexican president called him, invited him to Los Pinos, which is the Mexican White House. There was a parade in Mexico for him. And so every fight he had after that, that was his audience. That was his supporters. Those were his people until he challenged Julio. And when he challenged Julio, the Mexican community goes, oh, wait.
Ow.
Yeah, you're not that Mexican. You know, he's Mexican. You're not that Mexican. And then he was like, what?
He's Mexican. He's Mexican Jesus. He was Mexican Jesus.
He's like, you can't touch him. You can't touch Julio. He's our campeón de México, you know, el campeón del mundo. And and so that's the lens in which I wanted to explore this particular fight, because I think that we still encounter this today. We're not a monolithic group. I get that. We have a lot of differences, but we have bigger fights to fight outside of the ring as a Latino community. So whether you're Puerto Rican or Cuban or Central American or Argentinian or Venezuelan or Mexican, there is a collective aggregation that has to happen if we're going to have a political power, buying power. You know, if we're going to flex any sort of muscle, we have to do it together. And so we can't concentrate on how we're different in order to make change. We have to focus on what we have in common and the common goal, which is like, we should have access to voting. We should have access to healthcare. We should have access to equal education. There's stuff we need to come together on. And so, you know, the beginning of the documentary starts with those differences. It's, you know, the old, you know, the old lion against the young buck, and the Mexican national against the Mexican American, and the guy from the Pueblo against the golden boy. And the fight really promoted those differences, because boxing is a sport that has never shied away from using race. No. Right? Like it's leaned into it, if anything, or nationality, you know, the Italian against the Irish guy,
right.
You know, and the black guy against the Puerto Rican, and the, you know, and so, it did the same thing in this fight without understanding the civil war it would cause because of the nuances. They thought it was just two Mexican fighters, you know, heading head to head, but it was much more than that.
You know what I found really interesting about watching Julio and Oscar? Both of them seem so, and I don't mean this in a derogatory, they seem sweet. They seem sweet. They seem like, you know, because I've seen boxing documentaries, and a lot of these boxers, they're just brute barbarian sometimes in the way they speak, and they're not articulate. But Julio and Oscar both are, they seem so sweet that they almost kind of both fell into it. Like, it's just kind of like, oops, I guess I'm going to box. Kind of like you, like, oh, I guess I'm going to act. And it just seemed that way. And I saw that kind of energy from, especially Julio, which I wasn't expecting. He seems so sweet. And I'm like, but he was a killer in the ring. But it's just like, I mean, I think he disconnected the two. He's like, I'm a sweet guy, but I go to work.
Yeah.
Did you find that as well?
100%. And, you know, like I said, I've known Oscar for 25 years. Right. So I know he's sweet and I know him well. I didn't know Julio at all. I'd never met him. And I fell in love with him. He is such a truth teller. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting in a documentary about your life, about something that happened in your life. You could pretty much have revisionist history, like, oh, I wasn't bothered by that. No, you know, of course I won that fight. I wasn't whining about it. And he was like, yeah, there was no way at that moment I was going to say I lost, even though I knew I did. I knew I had lost, but I wasn't going to say it, you know, and you're like, wow. It felt like he had 2020 vision looking back at that fight. He was so open and vulnerable about his obstacles to fame, his addiction, his lack of preparation for other fights. You know, he's like, look, December is my party month. I wasn't about to fight in January, but it was $9 million. So I was going to fight. You know, he is very candid and vulnerable and kind. And it wasn't until 10 years after those fights that he finally gave Oscar the credit that was due. And then on Oscar's side, everybody who watches Doc goes, oh my God, I cried for Oscar. I didn't know he had that much pain going into that fight.
Right.
He was hurt. And then revisiting that, he's like, God, it still makes me mad. Like, he was still mad as we were interviewing him. I was like, oh yeah. He's like, God, I'm so mad just thinking about that, you know, getting booed in East LA. Like, what the fuck? Are you kidding me? Come on. You know? So painful for both.
Well, it's a beautiful film. I absolutely loved watching it. And congrats on getting into Sundance. That must be so exciting. And you get to, you know.
So huge that opening night is a film directed by a Chicana about two Mexican boxers. Like,
right.
This is progress. Let's savor it.
First of all, I think you are a absolute force of nature, and thank you so much for everything you do. And for my twin daughters, they said tell you thank you for Dora. They loved it and watch it all the time. So thank you so much for that.
I love that movie.
I saw it in the theaters with them. I went to the theaters with them, and it was back when you used to do things like that. But I do appreciate you, and thank you so much for coming on the show, and continued success. And I hope this movie gets out and is seen by everybody. It's such a wonderful film. So thank you again so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We all have a dream. We all have a mission here in this life. And so many times we put obstacles in our own way, and we do not let ourselves be guided by the universe, by God, by another force that is really helping us along the path. It has been my experience to sometimes just sit down in the river and let the river take you where it may. You have to work, of course, you have to do things to help it along the way, but the general direction is something that I feel that we all need to listen to, that inner voice, that thing that is pushing us. And Eva's story is a great example of that. I want to thank Eva
for coming on the show and sharing her journey with us. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch her new film, La Guerra Civil, head over to the show notes at nextlevelsoul.com/023. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and leave a good review for the show wherever you're listening to it. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, trust the journey. It is there to teach you. Talk to you soon.